This is the continuation of our oral argument calendar. The next case up is Isaac Zimmerman versus Crossroads Commons. It's the time set for the oral argument. I'm joined by Judge Bonnie Bulla, Judge Deborah Westbrook. I'm Michael Gibbons. And counsel, I don't think I've met you before, so I'll need some help on pronouncing your last name as to both of you. For the appellant, Andre
Labonte,
right? And for the respondent, Charles
Mihalik.
All right, so we have a silent C in there. Okay, thank you both for being here today. This is a very interesting case. We're looking forward to hearing the argument on this. There's a number of issues, but we'll let counsel frame that. Of course, we're going to have some questions. Mr. Labonte, do you want to save any time for a rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to save 3 minutes.
Okay, 3 minutes. Did you see what happened in the last case? Respondent's counsel offered some of his time to appellant's counsel.
Yes.
All right, we're ready to proceed then. You may go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Andre Labonte of GGRM Law Firm. I'm representing the appellant, Isaac Zimmerman. And as we discussed, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue in this case is that the lower court and opposing the defendants conflated my client's role as a precipient witness and as the plaintiff. The lower court also weighed the evidence, as they're not supposed to do in a motion for summary judgment. I have five issues that I'd like to cover. The first one's going to be the evidence of causation. The second one will be the estoppel issue that was brought up about Mr. Zimmerman's position change in the motion for summary judgment. And that's pursuant to Kennedy v. Allied Mutual and Luciano v. St. Mary's. Third one is Zimmerman's testimony and memory issues over time. I'd also like to discuss res ipsa loquitur and negligence per se. And then if there's time, I'll discuss abandoning the phrase proximate cause. I'm going to rest my argument about the granting of fees and costs on the briefing. So the first and most important issue is the evidence of causation in this case. The lower court stated that the reason for granting summary judgment was that there was no evidence of causation. However, in negligence cases, causation is often based not on positive proof, but by circumstantial evidence. It happens very often. A lot of times in slip and falls or accidents, nobody knows exactly what happened. They reconstruct the accident. They bring in evidence of people who saw different things to put together what happened totally. In this case, Mr. Zimmerman was riding his bike as he did all the time for recreation, for transportation, and he rode onto the Crossroads Commons parking lot behind the shopping stores. As he was getting closer, and none of this is refuted, he said this in his testimony and he's repeated it in the investigation, in his deposition, and in his response to interrogatories and other discovery requests. He went to the end of the line behind the stores, and the area that he got to towards the end before he turned towards the front of the stores was darkly lit. There wasn't good, there wasn't signage which indicated that there was a speed bump. He encountered a banana on the ground, which he tried to avoid on his bicycle and did not have enough time to slow down and hit the speed bump, went over his front handlebars, hit his face on the ground, was instantly concussed, did not remember what happened, and suffered damages as a result. That has always been Mr. Zimmerman's argument as a plaintiff. He's always believed that there was some issue between the banana and the speed bump that caused him to fall over his bicycle, because people do not normally go over their front handlebars without something happening.
Counsel, let's say we agreed with you that the district court may have erred in finding that there were no genuine disputes of material fact on the causation issue. What about duty and breach?
So
why couldn't we affirm on a different grounds? Because didn't the defense argue below that there was no duty that was breached?
And I think that that's a big part of their argument, both below and actually in their responsive brief. Ultimately, we have to take the lower court on its word. It said that it was basing its decision solely on causation.
Right, but we reviewed de novo. So why did you not address the issues that they raised in their answering brief?
I did not realize we were going to be reviewing that de novo.
What do you claim what was the duty that was breached?
So the duty is that they provided a travel lane for people who are shopping, and they had to provide a safe travel lane. Crossroads maintains this parking lot. They built the speed bump, which was illegal and unpermitted. And
yeah, what is your evidence that the speed bump itself was illegal?
So there's a problem with this case, which is that the plaintiff asked for discovery several times and has struggled to get any discovery. A couple years after while this case was still in discovery, the defendant took away the speed bumps and replaced them with speed humps, which are not illegal, which the fire department does permit. It doesn't permit the speed bumps that were there before because they are considered dangerous.
But sir, what evidence is there that the respondents had any actual or constructive knowledge of the hazardous condition on their property before the fall, with the opportunity to have remedied the condition before the incident occurred? What, or maybe I should say it this way, what genuine disputes do we have to look at in that regard?
So there's a claim of negligence per se because they did not follow the municipal standards for permitting the speed bump. It would not have been permitted because speed bumps are not permitted by the fire department. They do.
Counsel, what was the date that the municipal ordinance went into effect?
I do not have that in front of me. I could brief that.
Wasn't it after the accident?
I'm not sure about that. Okay. So on the estoppel issue, so the other side brought up Kennedy v. Allied Mutual and Luciano v. St. Mary's on trying to stop Zimmerman from his position change. In this case, both of those cases and the policy behind them is that facing a motion for summary judgment, a party should not be allowed to go back and get more evidence and change their argument to contradict with an argument they had before. In this case, they're pointing to the fact that Mr. Zimmerman updated his interrogatory answers. He did that before the motion for summary judgment, so it doesn't apply. He did not change his position in terms of in response to the motion for summary judgment. He changed it in the normal course of discovery, as you're required to by the procedural rules.
But he did introduce the affidavit of Ms. O'Brien Coates, correct, or Coates? I apologize if I mispronounced her name, but her affidavit was attached to his opposition to summary judgment. And it's in her affidavit for the first time that there is now an issue that the banana or banana peel existed at or near his location on the date of the fall. But before that, there was no evidence, was there, that the banana peel actually was present at the time he fell?
That's correct. Mr. Zimmerman was relying on his investigation that he did a couple days after the fall.
Didn't he say it was in the gutter?
He did. That it was near the edge of the road. It's a small pathway behind the stores where it turns up towards the front of the store.
Was he riding his bike in that area as opposed to more in the center?
No, we don't know exactly where he was riding his bike. So we're not saying that he was riding it towards the gutter, although he likely was closer to the buildings because he was turning up towards the front of the building.
So but, you're saying it was okay to change his position on how this happened?
He didn't change his position as a response to the motion for summary judgment. He changed it as his memory became more clear over time. And the affidavit was information that he already had that he wanted to enter. He knew that his sister, Ms. Coates, would be called as a witness, but he did not, he had not deposed her, and he did not realize that it would behoove him to get that information on the record before the motion.
When he was deposed, wasn't he asked about what his sister would say if she were deposed? And wasn't that question raised to him?
I don't recall that question.
Because I think he had said that she he didn't know what she would say about, you know, the day in question, if I'm recalling correctly.
I'm sure Your Honor is.
But why wouldn't we apply Newton then to say that Ms. O'Brien Coates' affidavit should not have been considered by the district court? Or Nutton?
Nutton. I think that you can discount that affidavit without changing this case at all. I think that Isaac testified, he was deposed and testified based on his understanding, his belief of what the involvement of the banana from the beginning.
So what genuine disputes of material fact do you believe still exist with respect to causation?
So the issue is, and it's factual causation, the issue of material fact here is that he was riding towards the speed bump. He went over his handlebars, went face first into the ground, and believes that the speed bump or something around it that he investigated later contributed to that. And the court decided that based on his memory gaining over time, and this was, Mr. Zimmerman was concussed at the scene and he lost consciousness. So his gaining his memory over time meant that he was unreliable and had no evidence. The fact that the security guard came up and saw him in that spot, concussed, and it was the same, it supported Mr. Zimmerman's explanation of how he was driving towards the area where the speed bump was and was injured. He didn't know how injured at the time. It wasn't until he started seeing the blood that he knew that he was actually seriously injured.
How would you respond to Crossroads Commons' argument that you presented no evidence that it knew or should have known about the banana?
So the maintain the security guard was an agent of the Crossroads Commons. They maintain the parking lot and the debris within it.
So even if it had only been there for 5 minutes, they should have known and cleaned it up?
No, I would say that is certainly an issue that has to be decided by a jury, because
what evidence did you present that they had knowledge that the banana was there?
We did not present evidence that they had knowledge that the banana was there.
Is it your position that Crossroads Commons violated a duty of care by merely having a speed bump on its property?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that that's a pretty strong argument. I would say that not having a speed bump stops people not by actually stopping people, but by warning you that if you don't stop, you're going to be impeded. And by not having adequate warnings, by having not good lighting in the area, they created a situation that is very dangerous. Let's see. I just want to quickly, under res ipsa loquitur, I did not address it. I just wanted to say that you can't throw out a res ipsa loquitur claim for lack of causation. evidence because causation evidence, it's a shifting of who has to prove causation when you use res ipsa loquitur. And I will, sorry.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Labonte. All right, Mr. Mihalik.
May it please the court, I am Charles Mihalik representing Crossroads Commons. Justice Westbrook, you brought up a good point about the duty breach causation issue. And the defendant has always maintained that there's been no showing of the duty and breach here. Sprague, all the way back in the 90s, has said just because you have an accident that occurs on the property, it doesn't mean that the owner of that property or the store owner is liable. And the problem with what the plaintiff wants to do is that they want to skip that and go to causation. And then skip causation, and they want a res ipsa instruction and force the defendant to figure out what it was that the plaintiff might have slipped on, and then whether that caused the injury. Plaintiff's counsel made a statement, and he said that the court weighed the evidence. And I don't think that's quite accurate. What the trial court did is they took a look at the very many contradictory statements that were made by the plaintiff. And Judge Gotti said, look, I can't credit any of these.
But are you allowed to make credibility determinations on summary judgment that go against the plaintiff?
Well, if you have three different stories, or in this case, five different stories as to what happened, and they're all under oath, which one are you going to say is credible and which one you're not going to say is credible? Which is why the case that I cited said, look, you cannot create a genuine issue of material fact if you're going to have contradictory statements under oath. I mean, the plaintiff...
But doesn't that apply after the summary judgment motion is filed?
So
the contradictory statements all came in before, in this case, from what I can tell, before the summary judgment motion was filed. So the case law deals with filing something in response to a summary judgment motion that creates a genuine issue. And under those circumstances, you're able to resolve the credibility. Why was the judge allowed to do something that went beyond that in this case?
Right. Actually, Justice Westbrook, if you look at the transcript of the hearing from Judge Scotti, and it's cited in my brief, the plaintiff for the first time comes up with the excuse about the amnesia that he has. And that's the explanation for why at his deposition he said that he didn't understand what it was that he'd slipped on. That came out for the first time the argument. Additionally, at the argument, he said, well, it wasn't a banana peel, it was a banana. And so there were contradictions there, actually, at the argument that Judge Scotti looked at and said, look, I can't find these things credible. And the listing of it, it's not just the banana.
Mr. Mahag, just to clarify one point. At the hearing, this goes to the point that was made by the appellant. Is the party Zimmerman a witness, or is he like his own counsel at this hearing? And when he makes a statement to the judge, he's not under oath. So is that treated the same as the previous statements that were under oath?
He's representing himself pro per. And I would agree that he may not be as familiar with the law as a lawyer would be, but he's certainly under the same obligations that he would be. If he's going to make a representation on behalf of his client, which in this case happens to be himself, he's telling the court what the excuse is, the amnesia that he's suffering. The court took that as evidence, as an understanding as to what his reason was. And if you look at the case law says that if you're going to get around the failure to contradict issue, right, then there's got to be an assessment by the trial judge as to whether there's good cause or good reason, an understanding as to, wait a minute, this is why you've changed the testimony.
But the contradiction didn't occur after the summary judgment motion. The contradiction occurred before, where he said, I didn't remember, and then he submits his interrogatory response, which says exactly what his theory of the accident was.
So there's a contradiction between the deposition and the interrogatories. And then there's another contradiction between the deposition, the interrogatories, and the actual argument. And then there's another contradiction between the deposition, the interrogatories, the actual argument, and the statement that he made to the security guard, where he doesn't mention a banana or a peel or the speed bump at all. And so it's a situation where, unfortunately, the plaintiff's change of story is happening multiple times throughout the litigation, and the trial court can't say, well, wait a minute, I have to consider under 56, this is your fact, this is the issue of fact, because there's five of them. The problem would be, Justice, if we went along with the plaintiff's theory, then the plaintiff can simply say, I have 20 things that I might have slipped on. And now we have to give credence to all 20 and say, well, the defendant, you have to figure out which ones were your fault or not your fault. Or that's an incredible burden to place upon the defendant, especially when we historically have said, look, the reason why we have the rules for Sprague is that you must prove what it is that you slipped on, or you got to prove that it was there for a length of time before we're going to hold you constructively liable. Now, there wasn't a banana peel that the security guard saw there. The only evidence of that there was a banana was a couple of days later when the plaintiff comes and says, now I see either a peel or a banana. And so, if he had said, hey, I slipped on a banana, right then and there, security guard could have went over to it, see if there was a banana. There was no residue left on the bike or on the plaintiff. And the plaintiff just said, I tipped over.
But aren't these questions a fact that maybe a jury should be able to consider instead of making a conclusion regarding causation? Or do you think these do not rise to the level of genuine disputes of material fact?
I do not think that they rise to genuine issues of material fact, Justice Bulla. And the reason why is you have a lack of knowledge for 3 years, 2 years, 3 years, as to what is going on, what the plaintiff slipped on. And then changes in that testimony under oath are made. And then further changes to that testimony is made at the hearing. And I think that Judge Scotty got it right. He's like, this excuse that you're giving me about having some sort of amnesia is I just don't buy it. I don't believe that that's a genuine issue. And I can't credit any of the other stories because it keeps changing.
And these issues, though, go to causation. We don't even get to causation unless there's a breach of duty, correct?
That's correct. And that was my point earlier, is that where is the constructive or actual notice? First of all, Crossroad Commons does not sell any bananas. I know the Whole Foods used to be a defendant in this case, and there was an attempt made that the banana may have come from there, but there's really no evidence of that whatsoever.
But it has to be constructive or actual knowledge by your client.
Correct.
That it was a dangerous condition that existed and should have been corrected. Mm-hmm. What is your response to the appellant's argument that the speed bump in and of itself, being in the location it was in the parking lot, was dangerous?
Sure.
Because the signs weren't posted, it was dark, there was not insufficient lighting.
So it's the 2 Record on Appeal, 365 to 372, and that's the fire department's assessment that there was no problem with the speed bump. I cited a couple of out-of-state cases in my brief about speed bumps. I didn't have anything specifically from you, and maybe this is a good opportunity to clarify. But the problem to me seems to be that if you have a speed bump, it's not a danger. It's a warning in itself. Why we have speed bumps is so someone does not speed through a school zone or a grocery store parking lot or another area. It's a warning for them to slow down. There might be pedestrians around. There might be other reasons. And so we don't consider those dangers. If this were an open pit, in the back of Crossroad Commons, and there wasn't any tape around it or warning, I would say, well, that's a danger. I would also say that might be open and obvious, but under Foster, that may not be sufficient. But here, we're talking about a safety piece of equipment, essentially. The speed bump is a safety feature to prevent people from speeding. And that's what the out-of-state cases have said. Now, even if that's we don't follow that, there's still no evidence by the plaintiff that there was anything wrong with the speed bump. There's no expert testimony. There's just speculation on that point. And so I don't think that would be sufficient just because I'm saying now that the speed bump is a danger. I wouldn't agree with that.
I want to turn to the attorney's fees issue briefly, if I may.
Sure.
So your motion requesting attorney's fees sought the fees only under NAR 20B2, correct?
That's correct.
But you later submitted an order that the district court signed where the court awarded those fees under both NAR 20B2 and NRS 18010.
That's correct.
How did that give Mr. Zimmerman adequate notice of the basis on which you were seeking fees? Particularly where he wasn't even provided a copy of that order before it was entered.
All I can say on that point is Judge Scotty made the decision as to what statute or what rule he was going to apply. I have had many cases where I've given trial judges multiple reasons why they should award fees, whether it might be EDCR 7.60, whether it might be NRS 18010, whether it might be Rule 11 sanctions, whatever. And the trial court picks and chooses. I don't know that that was really outlined in the opening brief as well for me to respond to that issue, but I hope I've tried to address it.
So the NAR 20B2A applies to fees that are awarded after the trial de novo request, correct?
There's two sections. I think it's an exclusive.
B2A is the one that you guys went under.
Right.
And as I look at the minute order in the record, it's at page 1052. It looks like the district court granted the motion for fees. And this is the quote, as consistent with the affidavit of Marissa Temple, at the time from plaintiff's request for trial through the date of this minute order, defendants shall recalculate the appropriate amount and include in the proposed order. But then the order that you submitted in which the court signed, I think it still included fees that predated the request for trial de novo, correct?
You're correct.
Okay.
The only thing, and again, what I could say on that point is I don't think that was outlined specifically in the opening brief. If the court's going to consider that, then you know a limited remand to would be appropriate on maybe us providing a better affidavit or more evidence on those fees.
I think though the argument was made that the fees awarded exceeded what were permissible under NAR 20B2. How do you respond to where the order did include fees that predated it?
Well, what I understood the plaintiff's argument to be was an issue with the limitation on attorney's fees from short trial rules and whether once a case is exempted from that short trial, the $3,000 limit applies. And that was
We saw that. I didn't quite understand where the $3,000 figure came because I didn't see that in his opening brief.
Okay. That was argued below. And when I did not see anything particular about that issue in the opening brief, I wanted to state my position before the court on that issue. Our request for fees would have been because the case was exempted from the short trial program and it was plaintiff who exempted it, we would be entitled to those fees. If I was unclear about that in the briefing, I apologize for that.
But you'd only be entitled to those fees from the time the de novo was filed forward.
I would agree that.
I've got a question related to the fees. It seemed that Mr. Zimmerman was allowed to pursue his case in form of papyrus. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And did the district court then relieve him of having to pay attorney fees and costs from the arbitration that occurred first? Do you know?
So because there was a trial de novo, so none of those fees were paid, it was determined that the when the order for fees and costs was made. So no, I do not have a specific ruling from Judge Scotty as to why I'm going to exempt the arbitration fees or not.
So we're now beyond the arbitration, though, and we know that the fee provision that you've requested runs from the time the de novo is filed to the present time under the rule that you requested attorney's fees and costs under. But I guess the concern would be if the form of properous is still in place, can you even receive a fee award?
Sure. I could briefly answer.
Yes.
I would say, I mean, if this were me making the law, the $3,000 for an arbitration would be its own separate situation. And anything, as you pointed out, the fees after the date would be what would be entitled to. Now, I do not think that there is a provision of informa pauperis that says, wait a minute, if you lose your case, you don't have to pay attorney's fees and costs. I think that the point of someone proceeding pro per in informa pauperis is that they don't have to pay the cost now during the litigation. They don't have filing fees. They don't have other costs maybe for what might be going on, depositions, whatnot. But that doesn't, at the end of the case, say, well, wait a minute, you're not liable for any potential fees and costs. If 18010 or NRS 7.085 or EDCR 7.60, if fees are going to be awarded, your in papera status, I don't think, prevents that award.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mihalik. All right, we have a short rebuttal from Mr. Labonte.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay.
So there are just three issues I want to talk about. The first one is that opposing counsel said that speed bumps are a safety feature, and I would just like to point out that I think it's well known to everyone who's ever encountered a speed bump that they didn't know was there before they got to it, that they are extremely dangerous if they do not have a warning. That is how they work. They become a safety feature, and they slow people down if people can recognize that the speed bump is there before they approach it. And in this case, they could not. Opposing counsel pointed out that we do not have expert testimony. We do not. We do have the agent of the defendant, the security guard, who said it's dark in there, that area. There isn't good lighting, and that there's not adequate signage.
How do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that there was a fire department assessment in the record that showed that there were no problems with the speed bump?
That was done after they replaced the speed bumps for speed humps. And so even though those were also not permitted, the speed bump was already gone. The speed bump in question was gone at that point. So they weren't commenting on the speed bumps that used to be there. A speed bump and a speed hump are completely different things. Speed bump is about 3 feet wide, and it's considered dangerous at any speed. A speed hump, you have to get to around 15 miles an hour, and you can travel over it reasonably in a car. That's included in the same in the information that was given by the
respondents would still have to have some knowledge, either constructive or actual, that there was a problem with incidents occurring with that speed bump, with or without the banana.
That's not necessarily true. I believe that if they created an unreasonable danger by putting a traffic impediment with inadequate warnings in a dark area, then by creating that unreasonable danger, it doesn't matter whether or not they knew that other people had gotten injured there. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. All right, thank you, Mr. Labonte.
Thank you.
Good job by both attorneys. Appreciate it. It certainly helps in our decision-making process. Anything further from you, Judge Westbrook?
No, thank you. Thank you both so much, and we appreciate, you know, pro bono cases and the assistance of Legal Aid Center, and thank you so much for the work that you did on this, Mr. Labonte.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll take this matter under submission for a written decision in the near future.